the ideas. We don't know God by the proposition. The proposition just trigger a non-rational experience of God that you can't put into words. I mean, it's like, no, that's not Christianity. But you're exactly right. There is the day that we imply that we've got our God all figured out. Okay. Is the day that we show that our God is not the God of the Bible. Our God is too small. Isaiah said that God's ways and his thoughts are as far above ours as the heavens are above the earth. And so, that's why the atheist is basically, they basically use the problem of evil, and the atheist argues, because Phil Fernandez can't explain the greater good that God is going to accomplish from every single instant of evil and innocent human suffering, therefore Phil Fernandez should give up on his God. And that doesn't follow. Because Phil Fernandez believes in the God of the Bible, who is a God who is infinite in wisdom. And so the idea that I'm going to figure out, basically, if I have a general understanding and know enough solid evidence for the existence of the God of the Bible and that he is a good God, then I have every reason to believe that in areas where I can't understand why he allowed an innocent little baby to suffer and to die, I can be very confident that he had a good reason for allowing that he's going to bring good out of it that goes beyond my understanding. There's nothing inconsistent with that at all. Now, it's like I say, if out of the 100 biggest questions that mankind has ever asked, it seems to me that God's answered about 95 of them. That Christianity answers about 95% of them. Atheism answers zero of them. So the atheist is saying, because the 5% that God hasn't answered, by the way, I think God hasn't answered 5% of our questions. There's also an infinite number of questions that we're not bright enough to even ask.
Yeah.
Okay, but the 5% of our questions that God has chosen not to answer, if the atheist is arguing, therefore you should reject Christianity and accept atheism, which doesn't answer anything. I mean, the atheist is reasoning that we should reject a rational cause for the universe, which then means that the reasoning processes of the atheism don't even have a rational basis. So just to reason against God implies that the universe has a rational foundation. And just the fact that people can argue against God's existence argues for it. That's why Cornelius Van Til said that non-believers live on borrowed capital from the Christian worldview. So that an atheist can argue against an atheist is like a guy who argues against the existence of air. The whole time while he's doing it, he's taking air in. And so you can argue against the existence of the rational God, but you sure, in order to argue at all, you're acting like you're a rational being. A limited rational being, which implies that you were caused, your existence was caused by an infinite rational being. See, if Christianity is true, then a rational God created us in his image, which part of that image would be that we would be rational beings, thinking beings. If atheism is true, how do they explain why humans are rational beings? In fact, usually atheists understand what Nietzsche said, that if there's no God, there's no absolute truth and no absolute morality. But if there's no absolute truth, no things that are true for all people at all times in all places, then even the statement there is no God is not true. So if they throw truth out the window, you can't say there's no such thing as truth. That's why I believe atheism is true. There's two problems with that. Number one, if there's no such thing as truth, then even atheism is not true. And number two, the statement there is no such thing as true as truth, in order for that statement to be true, it would be a truth. So it has to be false. It's a self-refuting statement.
Real quickly, the thing I was saying about the mystery too is that there is a part we can't know the essence. of what makes up God, God. You know, like even if there's a mystery about ourselves, we don't know.
Yeah, we don't even...
We have no way of knowing the mind of God what he's composed of.
I think Tom Morris and Feinberg could actually argue that God has three minds. Because it appears that you have three centers of consciousness. Now, there are two different types of Trinitarians. Social Trinitarians, who see God as basically a society of three, three eternal minds that are the one God. And others would say, no, that goes too far. But usually they end up with the traditional position, which I think is very unbiblical, where the Father eternally generates or begats the Son, and the Holy Spirit eternally proceeds from both of them. And so the Son and the Holy Spirit share the same being as the Father because it's His being, but their personhood is dependent upon Him, which places them lower. I really think it does damage, but you'll find that in the Nicene Creed. Talking about Jesus being eternally begotten of the Father, well, I think the scriptures are clear. He was begotten as a man. He was never begotten as God, the second person of the Trinity. He always existed as God, the second person of the Trinity. And the reason why we call Jesus the Son is because throughout all eternity, He knew He was going to become a man. But the Son of God speaks more about God become a man than it speaks about. That's why John even refers to Him before He became a man as the Word. But I actually think that by origin from the Alexandrian school, they were so steeped in pagan philosophy and Neoplatonic thought, the thought of Plato at that time, Clement Alexandria, then his pupil Origen, where he came up with this concept that Jesus was eternally begotten from the Father. Well, then Origen's student Arius said that doesn't make much sense. If he's begotten from the Father, then the Father created him at a point in time. Jesus is a lesser God. And that started the Arian heresy, modern-day Arians and Jehovah's Witnesses. But it all came out of that school of thought. That's one of the first things that Jehovah's Witnesses will slam Christians for, is how weird the concept of Jesus being eternally begotten. I think you can argue, though, the laws of logic are eternally begotten. They necessarily emanate from God. Okay, let's just take a look. I think what I'll do... we got a little bit of time. Okay, the teleological argument. Let's try this one. The design and order in the universe show that the universe needs an intelligent designer. You can even add C.S. Lewis onto this. There's like three basic ways of arguing for this. William Paley, his watchmaker argument. Thomas Aquinas had a really interesting argument from the mindless things of nature. And then C.S. Lewis had an argument in one of his works. I believe it was his work on miracles. We'll take a look first at William Paley. William Paley said that if you walked into the wilderness, and in the middle of the wilderness, if you found a watch, even if you had never seen a watch before, just by examining it, you would see that it was designed for a purpose. And that the evidence of the design in that watch shows that it needed an intelligent designer. Okay? Then William Paley argues that the human eye is far more complex, far more ordered, and well-designed than a watch. Okay? Therefore, the human eye needs an intelligent designer. Then Paley argues the whole universe shows evidence of design. Now we're finding, scientists call it the anthropic principle. Hugh Ross really goes to town on this. The anthropic principle, scientists argue that it appears that the whole universe was designed for the purpose of supporting life on the planet Earth. So you can look at our solar system, you know, move the sun a little bit closer to the Earth, no life possible. Move it a little bit further from the Earth, no life possible. The way the Earth revolves around the sun, you can go outside our solar system, you can go to the opposite end of the universe, and you just change the chemical composition a little bit here, a little bit there, and it would be impossible for life on the planet Earth. The rate of the expansion of the universe, if it was a little bit slower, a little bit faster, no possibility of life. So the anthropic principle, it comes from the Greek word anthropos for man, it says that it appears, the universe has the appearance of being designed for the purpose of supporting human life on the planet Earth. The crazy thing is that these guys are not arguing for God. They then take the anthropic principle and try to explain it away, why it appears to be that way. And they've got all these weird theories it'll come out to, like, you know, rap and stuff like that, where it'll have the first letter of one of the things that they're trying to say, and then they'll add AP for anthropic principle and stuff like that. And there's a whole joke that comes out of that. I don't know if you, Ross, made it, but I don't want to share it, but whatever the case, these guys are coming up with all these wild theories. Don't make a whole lot of sense to try to explain away what the anthropic principle shows. But what it amounts to is that what I tell people is, whether you look small or you look big, if you're open to God, if you're seeking God's face, you will see Him. You can look small. You can look at a single-celled animal. A single-celled animal has enough genetic, highly complex information called specified complexity, highly complex information, genetic information in a single-celled animal to fill an entire library with information. You don't get, you know, one of the illustrations that's been given is, no matter how many explosions you have in a print shop, you're never, through an explosion, you're never going to produce a Webster's Dictionary by chance. It takes an intelligent designer to produce a Webster's Dictionary. You get back to the Big Bang model, you combine that with a teleological argument from design. When's the last time? Where is the scientific evidence for an explosion? A random explosion that ever produced more order and more complexity. Explosions don't do that. If you explode a TV set, put a bomb in a TV set and blow it up, you've got all this order and complexity that now is set into a state of chaos. It doesn't go the other way. To say that the Big Bang model is evidence against God's existence is ludicrous. Because where is the scientific evidence? Where is the experimentation that shows that random explosions produce more order? They don't. Random explosions produce chaos. They don't design things. I asked Dan Barker when I debated him at Bellevue Community College, can you give me an example of one explosion that produces more order and complexity? Now, I should have said random explosion. But he stopped and he was like stunned, and all of a sudden his eye lit up, and I thought, oh no, because I think that guy is, sometimes I think he's demonically inspired. he said, yeah, when I turn the key in my car, it starts my car, gets my car going. And then I thought, oh no, now he's got me on the ropes. And then I said, but then all of a sudden I said a little prayer. I said, Lord, help me out. And then the answer came to me, and so I said, yeah, but Dan, I said, you would have to admit that a car is a product, a car engine is a product of intelligent design. And he said, oh, of course. And I said, thank you. There's another good argument for theism. And then the audience laughed, which was the only time they responded anyway in my favor that night. Every time I called God a he, they heckled me. So it was a, just get out of there alive. That was my goal for the night. Another illustration given, Hoyle and Gramercy were two of Great Britain's leading scientists. They're evolutionists, and as they examined the cell, the basic unit of life, they tried to calculate the chances of life spontaneously evolving from non-life. And the numbers, the probability of that occurring is so low that it's basically impossible. And so they left the evolution camp. Now, they're not Christians. They just push it back a little bit further. They believe aliens seeded the planet Earth, which just pushes the question back a notch, but shows how far people will go to avoid the God of the Bible. But whatever the case, Hoyle and Gramercy were not Christians, okay? They basically stated the chance of life evolving from non-life without intelligent intervention is the same chance, approximately the same chance, of a Boeing 747 being randomly produced from a tornado running through a junkyard. Okay? And you know, obviously that's not going to happen. This is what these guys said. This is what we're looking at. And it just doesn't happen. See, it takes, you know, if you have, if atheistic evolution was true, okay, little boys would not be hounded by their moms to straighten out their rooms. Because the chaos of their rooms would just, you know, the trend would be from disorder to order. But it's not. It's from order to disorder. And so little boys are told to use their intelligence to bring order back into the situation, which little boys don't want to use their intelligence for things like that. But whatever the case, so Paley would argue that this design and order in the universe show the universe needs an intelligent designer. By the way, his argument now is stronger now than it ever was, because now we look at things closer with the microscope. Things are much more complex and well designed than we ever thought before. Aquinas argued that, and I think Aquinas' argument. Did I include it? Let me see if I. No, I didn't include this argument. It's too bad. Aquinas argued that the mindless things in nature move in the direction of consistent goals. Acorns become oak trees. They don't become apple trees. Okay? And so Aquinas argued that just as it takes an intelligence... Whoa, there's that little thing again. There's like a little mole or something that runs...
Oh, right now you saw it?
Yeah. He came, out of the vent and went out that thing over there. That thing's got a mind there.
Yeah.
But whatever the case... Aquinas argues that the mindless things of nature, when they move towards goals, it's like an archer directing the arrow towards the bullseye. Okay? The arrow doesn't, and then the bow and the arrow don't have the ability to think, and so they don't do it on their own. It takes an intelligent archer to direct it and to shoot it there. So Aquinas said, when we see the mindless things of nature moving towards the same goals over and over again, it implies that these goals are prescribed and that there is a mind that works behind the mindless things of nature, moving them in that direction. And in other words, one way of looking at it would be that the natural laws of the universe in which we live had to be designed in such a way that things work according to certain patterns. And otherwise there'd be no rhyme or reason to what's going on. You know, another way of looking at this is, mathematicians, scientists now, a scientist has to be trained in math almost as much as a mathematician, sometimes more, to figure out all the mathematical equations to help us explain the universe in which we live. Well, it's like, hold on a second, if that's giving us real knowledge about the universe, which the scientists seem to think, then, I mean, you know, when you call it equations like E equals MC squared, so, but I mean, if we really are finding mathematical equations that help us explain the universe, then does that not imply the existence of an infinite mathematician who used his math to design the universe in accordance with those mathematical principles? Because if the answer is no, then it's just a game. And, you know, E equals MC squared makes about as much sense as squares are circles. Okay? It just, and everything's up for grabs. And, now C.S. Lewis, the way he argued for this, is that basically, you know, if you had an argument and you were trying to prove your case, in order to prove your conclusion, you would have to show that your premises are reasonable and that you've drawn a rational conclusion from your premises. If there is any premise there that's non-rational or irrational, your conclusion can be rejected, should be rejected. Unless they could find other rational grounds for it. And what C.S. Lewis is arguing is that the only way to base human reason, the only way to say that human reason makes sense and human reason is a worthy endeavor is if we can find a rational cause for it. In other words, Lewis is arguing that intelligence cannot come from non-intelligence. Okay? I say during my debates that, you know, hopefully this debate is evidence that human intelligence exists, that intelligence exists in the universe. I mean, if the guy debating me wants to try to defend the premise that intelligence is an illusion, fine, but he just forfeited the debate. Okay, because, I mean, he's implying that his view is more intelligent than mine. Well, if there's no intelligence, then there's no reason to debate. Mm-hmm. But if intelligence exists, can intelligence come from non-intelligence? And, you know, there's no way. So when you look, you know, can you get intelligence from a mound of dirt? You know, you just can't get it. Intelligence, and so Lewis argued that reason with a small r must come from reason with a big R. Minds with a small M must come from mind with a big M. Okay? And so there's different ways to argue teleological argument. I tell people my favorite teleological argument is my grandson Nathan. I saw him just moments after he was born. I wasn't an atheist. I was already a Christian. But if I were an atheist, holding a newborn baby in my arms, I mean, that would have shaken me out of my atheism, because there's no way that this baby is mere molecules in motion. There's no way that this baby just accidentally evolves, eventually going back to primordial soup, it just doesn't follow. I mean, you know, are we really supposed to... hand me a deism versus atheism book. Let me see if I can... Rarely do I ever quote myself. Usually I read my books to find a quote from... I'm just rambling on at this point in the debate, but it says, is it reasonable to believe that the universe popped into existence out of absolute nothingness entirely without a cause? Or is it rational to conclude that the universe is eternal despite the strong scientific and philosophical evidences that indicate that the universe had a beginning? Is the atheist justified in holding to the idea that time plus chance plus natural laws worked upon primordial soup until it eventually birthed a French philosopher who declared, I think, therefore I am? If atheism is true, then given enough time, it did occur. And then I kind of paraphrased Dwayne Gish a little bit later about this frog illustration. I said, atheistic evolution only appears plausible in slow motion. When we hear about a frog instantly becoming a prince, we call it a fairy tale. But if we are told that a frog became a prince gradually over a period of several million years, we call it science. Basically, you know, it's like you start with primordial soup and you end up with philosophers. And if you look where you start, you say, wait a minute, if we started here and there's no intelligent intervention, we're never going to get here. But what the atheist does, they slow it down and say, well, yeah, it went from here, primordial soup, to primordial soup a little bit more well-ordered, and then a little bit more well-ordered, and then a little bit more well-ordered. And, you know, after 100 hours of discussion, you've arrived at philosophers debating issues, and it seems, you know, it seems like, wow, yeah, it could have happened that way. The fact of the matter is, no, you can't get from primordial soup to philosophers who intelligently debate issues without an intelligent cause, an intelligent designer, you know, moving it. Basically, when I argue against evolution, I argue that if evolution needs God, but God doesn't need evolution, I argue that if evolution is true, it would still need God to bring the universe into existence from nothing, to bring life from non-life, complex life forms from simple life forms, animals with backbones from animals without backbones, and then a whole chain of other creatures until eventually you get to man. Every one of those violates different scientific laws that there is a wealth of scientific evidence for, okay? And so when a scientific law is superseded, we call that a miracle. So if atheism occurred, the only way atheism could have occurred is if a whole lot of miracles occurred. And it seems to me that if you believe in miracles because you believe in a miracle-working God, that makes more sense than to believe in miracles without a miracle-working God. So if evolution is true, it needed God to direct it. Having said that, though, once you posit the existence of God, he doesn't need evolution. And then I would argue that if he did use evolution, you could almost accuse him of deception, because he sure covered his tracks. Evolution doesn't have any explanatory power whatsoever unless you first assume there is no God. Now, how did we get here? Okay? So when you assume there's no God, you say, and then you assume that non-living things were first and then living things, well, where do the living things come from? Well, since from nothing, nothing comes, the living things had to come from whatever was in existence, well, non-living material. Yet that violates the law of biogenesis, which says that life, living things only come from prior living things. It violates the cell theory. It says the cell is the basic unit of life. All cells come from pre-existing cells. Yeah, you'll see it in the college textbooks. All cells come from pre-existing cells. However, this, of course, does not apply to the first cell, which had to have evolved from non-living material. Where's the evidence for that? There is no evidence presented. But they're assuming there's no God, so there's nowhere else it could have come from. But the fact of the matter is, now we know how big of a jump it is to go from non-living material to a living thing, a cell. And it's too much of a jump to be made without intelligent intervention. So the teleological argument is a strong argument. The moral argument, Immanuel Kant has used time and time again. His arguments are used to argue against God's existence. But that's only because he didn't like all the arguments presented on this page, except the moral argument. Kant, and I disagree with him, but Immanuel Kant argued that in his critique of pure reason, he argued that through pure reason we could not find God. We cannot find God through pure reason. Okay? Through pure reason we're left with, we can know things as they appear to us, but not things as they really are. Just a whole mess. You end up with skepticism and agnosticism. But even Kant admitted, though, that through practical reason, just because we're humans and we have to live life, that in order to live as human beings, okay, in order to live the good life, we have to presuppose the existence of God and life after death with punishments or rewards. In other words, man can't live without moral laws, but moral laws don't make any sense unless God exists and unless there is life after death, punishments and rewards. So therefore, let's presuppose that stuff or we're going to kill each other. So Kant is like, the atheists act like he's a friend of theirs, when in actuality, he believed in the existence of God and used the moral argument to argue for it. C.S. Lewis, just like he argued in his book Miracles, from nature is non-rational, but humans are rational, therefore our reason couldn't come from non-rational nature. It had to have a rational cause. There has to be a rational God. Reason with a capital R. He does the same thing with morality in his case for Christianity, which I believe now is part of Mere Christianity. He argues that nature is non-moral. You know, if you tripped over a rock, okay, and you started yelling at the rock and holding the rock morally responsible for you, other people who are hiking with you would probably, you know, want to avoid you from that point on, because we don't hold rocks morally accountable. The rock is a non-moral entity. And so if we came from nature, where did our morality come from? And C.S. Lewis says you could try to deny morality, but we all imply that moral laws are real when we are wrong. You know, there's no such thing as right and wrong, says the philosophy professor in a debate, but then he goes to his car after the debate and feels real smart and real intelligent until he finds out that his car window is broke, is shattered, and somebody stole his stereo from his car. And he feels like, oh, I have been wronged, and now he calls the police to bring justice into this situation. That whole scenario makes no sense if there are not real moral laws. Now, my own argument for the moral argument for God's existence, I've even had atheists on the internet. They were trying to refute William Lane Craig's moral argument. I think they did a poor job at that. But then then they said that Craig didn't take the argument far enough, but we found one theist who takes the argument to the next level. And then all of a sudden, there they were quoting from one of my books. And then they tried to refute me, and I don't think they did a good job there. Somebody alerted me to that because they thought that the guy was slamming me, and I actually, the atheist was paying me a compliment and saying I was taking one of Craig's arguments. Well, Craig had never brought it. Look at page 33. Page 33, down at the bottom, is the argument for the absolute moral law. So when you argue for the absolute moral law, the very next premise or the conclusion of the absolute moral law, if an absolute moral law exists, then an absolute moral lawgiver must exist. By an absolute moral law, we mean universal moral laws, moral laws that are true at all times, at all places, for all people. Okay? We don't have to agree on how many there are. Okay? We don't have to believe, well, every moral law, everything that God says thou shalt, is an absolute moral law. If that's the case, we ought to build the temple and start slaughtering animals right away, because God commanded that. But we don't believe that's an absolute moral. That was a specific law for the nation of Israel at a specific time. But thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not murder innocent people. That's an absolute moral law. The most obvious absolute moral laws: thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Okay, those are the two clearest moral absolutes, and all the other moral absolutes flow from them. Okay, now some would argue against that and say, you know what, the moral law, it originates with the individual. Each person themselves decides what is right and what is wrong, okay? So my first point there is that the moral law doesn't originate with the individual. For then, one individual could not call the actions of another individual wrong. In other words, I wouldn't be able to say that Adolf Hitler's actions were wrong, because he was his own moral lawgiver, if the individual settles the matter on what is right and what is wrong. But even the atheist wants to call Hitler's actions wrong. So, you know, some atheists will say, well, okay, but maybe it's a society. A few people get together and say, hey, if we're going to survive, we've got to live together in peace. If we're going to live together in peace, we've got to make some laws. So maybe each society develops their own laws. Problem with that, though, the moral law isn't created by each society, because then one society could not call the actions of another society wrong. America and the Allies could not call the actions of Nazi Germany wrong. So then maybe an atheist would say, okay, well, maybe the moral law comes from the world consensus. Okay? A lot of problems with that. For one thing, you know, what is a world consensus? I mean, sometimes I think you can get a world consensus, but for the most part, they would say, well, the world believes such and such. It's like, whoa, how come I wasn't? Nobody gave me a vote. I didn't have a button, and it's, what's your opinion on this? And I pushed yes. And so how do you get a world consensus? But what appears to be a world consensus from the past, the world was wrong in the past. One time, most people on the planet Earth thought the world was flat. They thought that the sun revolved around the Earth rather than the Earth revolving around the sun. They considered the world consensus was that slavery is perfectly right and perfectly permissible. The woman was considered property of the man that has having no rights in ancient times. And so if the world consensus was wrong in the past, what makes us think that now all of a sudden the world consensus is right? So world consensus, society, all that does is it adds more men and women quantitatively. That's not what the issue is. We need a moral law qualitatively above mankind. And so basically we need a moral law that's above all individuals in order to judge individuals by a standard that is above all individuals. But a moral law that is also above all society, so we can judge the society and say Hitler's society was wrong. But also a moral law that is above any world consensus, so that we can say the world of ancient times was wrong to have slavery. Okay? Now the thing is, though, even atheists will condemn the world consensus of the past and the world consensus of the present and say that we need to make changes, and they'll join some protest. They'll say we need better treatment of homosexuals or whatever, and they'll protest, or we need abortion rights for women. Whatever it is, the atheists will try to make, in their mind, the world a better place to live. Well, number one, they're appealing to a standard of right and wrong that is above the world consensus, because they're trying to change it, they're trying to make the world a better place to live. But they're also implying that this world standard is unchanging with time, with the passage of time. What I mean by that is they're condemning the actions of the past and the present by the same standard, and they want to make the world a better place to live. They're implying that this moral standard that's above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus, is unchanging with time. Okay? Now, when you put all of this together, okay, you know, we need to recognize that we're talking about moral laws that say, thou shalt this and thou shalt not that. These are prescriptive laws. They're not descriptive laws. Not like the laws of nature that describe the way things are. These prescribe the way things ought to be. Just as you can't get a prescription drug without the signature of the doctor, a prescription with a prescriber's signature on there, you can't get a moral law without a prescriber. You can't get a moral law without a moral law giver. Okay, a moral laws are commands. You don't get commands without a commander. Okay? And so it's not the moral law is not descriptive of the way things are, they're prescriptive of the way things ought to be. Therefore, the moral law needs a moral lawgiver. Okay? And if we want to condemn the actions of the past, this moral lawgiver, which is this above all individuals, above all societies and any world consensus, if we want to condemn the actions of the past, this moral lawgiver must also be eternal and unchanging. So those are just different types of moral arguments for God's existence. Now, what we'll do next week, we'll look at my cumulative case for God's existence. I think there's so many good arguments for God's existence. Rather than put all my eggs in one basket, I would rather use a cumulative case and show that the belief in God's existence is more reasonable than atheism in several different aspects of human experience, and so we'll look at that next week, and that's about all we have time for tonight.